Hello, I'm Nick Spencer, and you're listening to the 9th series of Reading Our Times. In this series, we're navigating our way through a world of confusing and often contentious ideas, equipped only with big books, serious authors, and time to think. We're going to be talking about slavery and reparations, wokery and left-wing politics, poetry and our sense of the sacred. We're going to talk about the origins of the West, what's behind the assisted dying debate, about the way the Enlightenment has been co-opted into the culture wars, about how our evolutionary past continues to shape our political present, and in a live recording at the How the Light Gets In Festival in London, I'll be talking to critics and publishers about books and the future of civilization. And underneath it all, of course, lies the question to which Reading Our Times always gravitates. What does all this say about the human condition? Hello, and welcome to a live recording of the podcast Reading Our Times, which comes to you from the How the Light Gets In Festival in London. Reading Our Times is a podcast about books, about ideas, about us. It tries to be an antidote to a scrolling, scanning culture by turning our attention to big, serious books and talking to authors who've expressed their opinions in 300 pages rather than 300 characters. But here's an alarming thought. What if it's all coming to an end? What if the age of the book is over? It sounds alarmist, but the number of bookstores, especially independent ones in the UK, has fallen precipitously over the last 40 years. According to research by the National Literacy Trust, there's been a 26% decrease in the number of children and young people who read daily in their free time since 2005. How we're reading is also changing. One of my former interviewees was Professor Marianne Wolfe, who wrote the book Proust and the Squid, The Story and Science of the Reading Brain. A few years later, she wrote a book called Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World, in which she wrote, in the 7 years it had taken me to describe how the brain had learned to read in its 6,000-year history, our entire literacy-based culture had begun its transformation into a very different digitally-based culture. All this has caused some people to make some apocalyptic suggestions. Some scholars have suggested that the period of human civilization dominated by the written as opposed to the spoken word will end up being an exception rather than the norm. The Danish scholar Lars Ole Søberg coined the phrase the Gutenberg parenthesis to refer to this anomalous period in which the printed word was central to culture. The writer Jeff Jarvis wrote an entire book on the subject, and the literary critic and professor of literature John Carey wrote in his book Pure Pleasure, reading and civilization have grown together. The imaginative power reading uniquely demands is clearly linked psychologically with a capacity for individual judgment and with the ability to empathize with other people. But maybe we're getting things out of proportion. Publishing remains a multi-billion dollar industry. Bookshops have rallied of late. Kindles did not do away with the printed book, as some people were predicting. Over the last two decades, the UK has seen a growth of small independent presses, as well as BookTok and Bookstagrammers. Adults have always nagged children to read. And in any case, who said literacy was the same with morality anyway? So what exactly is happening? And more importantly, does any of it matter? Is the book in decline? Is reading in decline? And what would it matter if they were? To discuss this, I'm joined with three people who know the world of books and reading inside out. Johanna Thomas-Kaur is the chief literary critic for culture and books at the Sunday Times and has also written and reviewed for The Observer, The Financial Times, The New Statesman and The Evening Standard. David Sharat Mdhari is literary editor at The Guardian, covering non-fiction and the author of Don't Believe a Word, The Surprising Truth About Language. And Juliet Mabey is the publisher at One World with an astonishing record for picking and publishing prize-winning literary fiction, having published Marlon James's A Brief History of Seven Killings, Paul Beattie's The Sellout, and most recently, Paul Lynch's Prophet Song, all of which won the Booker Prize. Please join me in welcoming them to the show. Julia, let me start with you. You founded One World in 1986. How has the book world changed since then?
Well, I think the whole world has changed since then. We started with a typewriter, a photocopy machine, and access to the fax via a post office. So if you imagine what the email, internet, digital facilities have done to the book world, it's massive. I mean, we've now got, as you say, ebooks, audiobooks. We can send files to the printer over email or upload them to an FTP site. So publishing has changed enormously, but also more recently, the way not just the way we publish books, but the way we promote books are hugely influenced by digital, by social media, by newspapers having more online space than print. So a lot of things have been transformational, and it's had an impact on publishers, and they've responded accordingly.
What do you think has been the most positive changes in that time for you as a publisher?
I mean, I think most publishers around the world originally regarded online bookselling as a challenge, but actually it's a boon in a world where bookshops can't stock all the books that are out there. So it's a shop window for everything. So that is a very positive thing. And, the fact that people can buy a book anywhere in the world now, I mean, even in the third world, so many people have phones where they can download a book, whether it's for educational or casual reading. I mean, that's hugely transformative.
Does it make it economically tougher?
Publishing's always tough. It's a risk management business. I think what has made publishing tougher for independent publishers like us is the conglomeration of the large publishers. You know, that when you've got 5-6 publishers all owned by either European or American parent companies, it does make it harder for independents to find the space to publish and the megaphones to talk about their books. It does make it harder, but I think everything's cyclical, and people thought it was very hard 20 years ago when bookshops in America, B. Dalton and Walden Books, collapsed, and up in their place came Borders and Books etc. and Barnes and Noble, which are, you know, the latter of which is now thriving. So I think publishers are quite resilient, and readers are incredibly resilient. So, you know, audiobooks have been expanding massively. So people will find things to read where they want. I think publishers have stayed true largely to their core markets, although those markets have changed.
Yeah. David, looking at the trends from the other side of the desk, as it were, what trends have you noticed in books that are coming across your desk at The Guardian?
And I think one that's probably relevant to the grand scope of this talk is this idea of books that are kind of theories of everything. So the book that will provide an overview, a sort of a way of looking at the world, a way of making sense of the world. And, you know, you get that going back to Sapiens. You know, Yuval Noah Harari, and he's got a new book out, actually, I think, this week, or possibly, yes, Nexus, about information. I mean, Piketty's Capital is another example of that. There was even a book last year by Michael Muthukrishna called A Theory of Everyone. So these are the books that are sort of taking this very turbulent and confusing world that we live in and attempting to arrange it in some sort of order for readers. And I think there's a real clamour for that. That would be a sort of big trend that particularly in nonfiction I see.
Well, one of the other trends that I've noticed is, if you like, the discrete or episodic nature of a great deal of nonfiction publishing. So the history of whatever it is in 100 objects or people or maps and so on and so forth. Is that just kind of surfing in on the extraordinary success of Neil McGregor's 100 objects? Is that kind of trend going to die out, or are we left with hundreds of objects for eternity?
I think it probably is partly from Neil McGregor's book. I mean, it's a neat... It's a kind of marketing nugget as well, isn't it? But it also has some appeal in terms of, okay, this is a book that I don't have to read all the way through necessarily. I can dip in and out of, or I can read episodically, as you suggest. So I think there are sort of benefits to the sort of to the publishers and the marketers and to the consumers. I don't know whether it will last necessarily. I mean, it has some kind of affinity with the sort of fragmented nature of reading, which we're probably going to talk about a bit more as we go on, and the sort of the way we consume text in general now is a bit more like that, whether it's Substacks or you know, even down to tweets. So there could be something around.
So it might be following a kind of an electronic trend, as it were.
I mean, I suspect it's more. I'm more on the it's marketing side of things, but yeah, there could be something. Yeah.
And briefly, and you could tell us honestly, as literary editor, when you see another history of absolutely everything in six objects coming across your desk, do you think, oh no, not another one, or do you think maybe?
I think often these books, actually, to give them their due, are works of real. They're often the summation of a scholar's work in a particular field, and they're packaged in a certain way. To make it sort of digestible. But yeah, and you can sort of tell if it's shonkily put together or whether it really is one of these, you know, someone's life's work condensed. And I think that has to be given credit.
Yeah, yeah. Joe, you made headlines last year when you exposed a certain book blurb as being, quote, a gross misrepresentation of your review of it. Do you think this has got worse? Is there an honesty issue with publishing?
I mean, you make me sound a bit like I've been involved in a huge tabloid scandal here. To give you a bit of context for this, although I think it has become known as Puffgate now or Blurbgate, this was a review I wrote in the New Statesman when I worked for the New Statesman, and it was about a sort of 2,000 word essay on Jordan Peterson's, I think it was called Beyond Order. So it was the sequel to his 12 Rules to Life. And what I guess made this slightly ironic as well is that in his first book, Rule 8 is tell the truth, don't lie. So I did find this. I actually only discovered when it got to paperback stage that I'd been completely misquoted. So I think I'd, you know, mostly it was a very critical piece. I think I'd called it lumpy. I think I'd said that it was cowardly. And I think there was one passage where I praised it, I think, here, for being genuinely enlightening and often moving. But that's because, as critics, we try really hard to write balanced reviews. Mm. And so when I think it was through my colleague, James Marriott, who also had his review misquoted, and he went on Twitter, and then it exploded into this huge thing where I realised that I'd also been misquoted. Now, this was from Penguin and Alan Lane. And, you know, Alan Lane has an incredible history, you know, obviously Lady Chatterley's lover. It's a respected imprint. And I think what was really upsetting is that, one, you know, Jordan Peterson is a fairly controversial character. Alan Lane is not a rackety operation putting out a few left-wing pamphlets or right-wing pamphlets or whatever. It's a major publisher. And I think in a day and age where people feel increasingly they can't trust what they're seeing online, there is a sense, often a misguided sense, that we trust a publisher like Alan Lane. But I think this speaks to a sort of broader problem that is going on with blurbs and puffing. I mean, this was a very extreme example of dishonesty, but a kind of devaluing of praise. I mean, we're seeing the same people often wheeled out. I mean, the dark arts of publishing. Does your average reader care? Well, to some degree, they should, because it's a matter of trust. So, you know, publishers will often go to someone who they publish on their list and say, can you praise this book? Or to that person's agent. And you see the same people come out again and again with the same kind of overblown adjectives. But the problem is it's become a bit of an arms race. If you don't have, you know, 15 blurbs on your book, then is anyone going to care or notice anymore? But then does it really mean anything? Yeah. So there is the thing about integrity and honesty here. And as critics, our currency is our opinions and our value judgments. And more people will see my quote on a Jordan Peterson than will have read my review.
Yeah.
And so that devalues my, you know, whether readers can trust us.
And I think trust is incredibly important here, because if you think about the other obvious source where people will consume information from, online, one of the accusations that's relentlessly thrown out online is, don't trust it. I don't know where the sources are. It's not necessarily trustworthy. And perhaps even subconsciously, I at least think, well, it's been printed. You know, they've gone to the effort of proofreading it and printing it and marketing it. And there's a kind of a solidity and trustworthiness to books which I think is really important to their kind of social authority.
Yeah, but I think to connect this a bit with what Juliet's saying about risk-taking in publishing, and I think it does relate to this, because it's this kind of emphasis on marketing and just kind of gushing, getting it out there. And more we're going to the same names, the same people praising things, because we're frightened of taking risks. And as Juliet said, it's really, really hard to run a publisher like she does, where you're managing that risk all the time. But increasingly, we're seeing this narrowing of voices at a time when we think we're seeing a kind of diversity on one level. And we think that because of the political upheaval that we've had in the last few years and the need and talk for need of diversity. But I think when I speak to publishers and editors, a lot of the time they're kind of privately saying, you know, we're having to lean quite hard on things like reader insight surveys and sales data. And the problem with that is actually they think it's forward looking. It's actually in some ways backward looking, because if you're looking at what's done well before, how do you know what's going to do well in the future? And we're seeing this in journalism too. We're seeing it everywhere, this kind of leaning very, very hard on our data, not really thinking, well, what's necessarily going to be the new thing, or taking some risk here. So I think we're really struggling with that. And ultimately that fails the reader, because it's a sort of failure of imagination.
Yeah, that's very interesting. The talk in this tent beforehand was about the influence of algorithms. And one of the points that somebody was making is that algorithms give you what you've already selected.
Yeah.
And arguably books and literature and nonfiction should do something different and push you beyond what you're already familiar with. David, I want to ask a bit about reading habits today. I'm interested in not so much how much people are reading, although that is itself relevant, but whether in your experience in this world, people are reading differently. Has the smartphone changed the way we read?
I mean, the smartphone has changed so much, hasn't it? And everyone here has sort of everyday personal experience of that. I think undoubtedly it's changed the way we read. Whether it means that there's an interesting thing, isn't there, which we may come on to about, is the total amount that we're reading actually decreasing, or has it potentially increased? Because we have access to these devices all the time. We can read at the bus stop, we can read as we're walking along, as people increasingly do. So the amount of text that we're consuming may be increasing. What's the character of that reading? What's the sort of feel of that reading experience? I would say it's fragmentary, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think probably a lot of people's consumption of text now is quite magpie-like, and you will flit through a link from one thing to another. And similarly on your, I mean, everyone has this experience on their laptop or computer of having like 30 tabs open. And it's because you've seen a link and magpie, like, you've gone for it. And you're like, oh, I'll read a bit of this. Now, there's a sort of treasure trove aspect to that. And, you know, that is the wonder of the internet, which is something to be grateful for. There's also, I suppose, the idea that it shatters our attention spans, reduces them. Reduces the amount that we kind of can concentrate on anything for any length of time. Now, I don't know what the research says around that, really. Instinctively, that sounds like it should be the case. But also one thing I can't help noticing is that actually attention spans are doing okay in terms of the sort of 15-part podcast you might be listening to, or the 12-part documentary about Zelensky or whatever that you might, you know, follow through all the way to the end. So clearly there is that appetite for depth.
I think that's a very important counter-argument. I was going to ask Joe about that as well. I mean, I remember reading somewhere that agents and publishers were encouraging authors, fiction authors, to write longer books because they thought so many of their audience were immersed in 8-season Netflix box sets, and they want a massive sweep of narrative and character development. Now, that would go completely counter, as Dave was just saying, to the idea that we can't concentrate for very long because all we consume is tweets. I mean, is that happening?
Yeah, I think to a degree it is, but I think then you look within that book or within that series, and I think it's not just like longer books, it's multi-part books as well. And actually, often they're divided up into small chunks, which have these sort of peaks and troughs, a bit like watching a series, whether that's a documentary series or whether that's a sort of TV quick series. So you get these sort of strange false flourishes at times, or ending on a cliffhanger. So I think the idea of books in some ways being imitative of the kind of filmmaking craft is definitely there. But I also think it's really interesting because when I speak to people in TV and film, they're often saying to me, OK, what material have you got from the books world? More and more people in film and TV are trying to take articles, books, novels as material to get things greenlit. So sometimes it feels a bit like, and I've known writers and filmmakers who've had things refused and then gone away and written them as a book in order to then get them made
back
into
to the
a
film.
Yeah, so, and I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing, these interesting relationships with other forms. It can create really, really interesting things. But I think if you're starting to see the same kind of narrative patterns, both in fiction and in non-fiction, that's where it does become a bit boring. I'm seeing that quite a lot, you know. And I think, actually, interestingly, in Rachel Kushner's new novel, Creation Lake, which is just on the shortlist for the Booker Prize, she slightly, I think, is kind of mocking this at the end of each chapter, each short chapter, where she tries to end on this cliffhanger. And she talks about the way in which this writing is going on more and more, this attempt at short sentences, cliffhangers. Yep. And you definitely see that.
So it's a combination of the episodic and the sustained as well, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So I think it is complex. It's not straightforward. Yep. It's not like... And I also think there's other things going on in the book world about length, and I think... And I'd be interested to see what Juliet thinks about this, is sort of the erosion of the editor role.
Yep.
And books are just getting huge, and you just feel like, you know, my common complaint, and I feel so boring in so many reviews, is this book could have been 100 pages shorter. Yeah. This book could have been 200 pages shorter. This is a short story. It's not a novel.
Yeah.
This happens a lot.
Should editors cut? Should they be tough, Juliet?
Oh, I mean, I think there are... the editor's job is definitely to put themselves in the position of the future reviewer and reader. I mean, that is the job, is to try and help the author write the best book they can. It's not always possible for an author to follow an editor's instructions. And authors, certainly when they become relatively famous, the editors are very nervous of giving them instructions because their job is to hold that author within the publishing company they work for. So there's a little bit of a conflict. There's some famous people who say, oh, they never wrote a good book after they won the Booker. Obviously, I can't name any names and I can't think of anyone who that would apply to. But it's a difficult relationship to maintain with an... If you're trying to say, as an editor, this needs to be developed or improved or 200 words cut or start again, you can undermine the author's confidence and then you don't have anything. So it's a very delicate balance. There's a lot of psychology involved as well as experience, so it's not easy. But there are definitely some publishers where their model is to... More of the ebook straight publishers who their model is really not to edit. It's to get things out there and see what sticks. That's a tiny minority of the market.
I do remember reading a review of one of the later Harry Potter novels. This was 20-plus years ago, and the reviewer said, you know, it could have done a lot better if it weren't 900 pages long. But then someone pointed out, OK, are you going to edit a woman who's just sold 50 trillion copies around the world? She probably thinks she knows her art better than you do. I want to ask you about children's literacy. I noticed that One World have just published Sam Leith's book, A History of Childhood Reading, which is getting very good reviews. One of the probably most worrying sets of data in all this is from the National Literacy Trust about the extent to which, for example, 34% of Britons over 55 read at least once a day compared to 7% of 18 to 24s, and it may even be lower amongst young adults. You know, look, would One World be able to publish a sequel to Sam Leith's History of Childhood Reading in 50 years' time? Will this just be a memory?
Who'll be running One World there? I do think that children's literature will survive. You know, as I say, a lot of things are cyclical. There are a lot of good developments that have come with digitization, for example. You know, a lot of children's books have interactive elements. They have audio sound over it, which helps them with reading. I think that the children's market is a very vibrant sector of the industry. We publish very little in that sector, but we do publish some books. But I think there is a tendency, I think, from a customer and bookseller point of view, to focus very much on the books that they know parents loved as children. So there's a heritage aspect to it that drives sales. But I think that if you look at the teen market, for example, which is still children's publishing, everybody assumed that because they're on their phones all the time, they will be the first adopters of ebooks. And actually, they very much like physical books. And in fact, the ebook market for our YA books is tiny compared to the physical print edition. And there are a lot of factors of that, including things like the subscription boxes, which are a lot of them are aimed at teens, and they can sell 15,000 hardbacks in a day by releasing them all at the same time, which is great for obviously books and data. So they are very much about physicality. And, of course, we were all told when the e-book started that physical books were dead. And what publishers have done to respond to that is by putting a lot more effort into the finishes of the book and the quality of the book. So you won't get cheap paper. You'll get beautiful foil embossing, cut-out covers, all sorts of things to attract the reader to the physical edition.
Yeah.
So I think children's market is definitely robust. And I can't imagine it changing in the next 50 years, but sadly we won't be here to publish the sequel.
I can't help thinking that's one of the reasons of the success of the Fitzcarraldo books, because they publish some Nobel Prize winning authors, but they publish some very, very beautiful books when they look good on the shelf. I want to ask all of you about the rise in audiobooks and podcasts and whether that oral receipt of information or stories is changing, A, the way we kind of consume and engage with information, but B, the book world more generally. Anyone want to pick that one up?
I mean, I think for me, some days, if I get out one side of the bed, I can get apocalyptic and moral panicky about it. If I get out the other side, I'm just hugely broad-minded and think it's a different gateway into the word. And I mean, just let's take audiobooks for a start. I mean, I'm probably one of those page-based snobs who thinks that listening to audiobooks is cheating. And I confess that I have been in that position. But I think that's simply because I'm just not someone who really retains information in that way. And also because I have to read on the page. But actually, in recent years, I've found it very, very helpful if I have to read an author's backlist to go and listen to it. And I'll speak to other friends who'll say, oh, well, I'll only listen to audiobooks if it's nonfiction, or I'll only listen to it if it's romance fiction. Everyone has a different approach to their audiobook consumption. I think there's few people I know who only listen to audiobooks. And if you're like in the privileged position of my husband, who will often have the book because we're sent it, and then he'll read half of it or read bits of it. And then if he's doing the housework, he'll listen to it because he'll be interested. And for example, there are just some formats that work better in audiobook. Memoir, anything that's first person does work really, really well as an audiobook. If you've got a really great narrator, I mean, like a Tom Hanks doing Patchett, for example, or Mel Streep. So I think it really, really depends on that. But in terms of, yes, podcasts. Yeah, I mean, I studied literature at university, and I've got friends who got much better results, you know, double firsts in literature, who say to me, I don't read books now, I just listen to podcasts. And they'll listen to a sort of 20-part podcast on the kind of the factors that led up to World War One. I was just like, who's got time for that?
But they wouldn't read an 800-page book on the subject.
No, they wouldn't. And that's interesting because these are people who read. But then the flip side of that is that a lot of people who didn't really read, who I knew at university, are now really into novels. I think we can kind of panic about this. I think the reality is that people have moments of discovering things at different stages.
Yep.
They have times where they retreat back into fiction, or they're more interested in non-fiction. And people's reading journeys are eccentric and very much dependent on their own life circumstances or their interests. So I think there's a danger of panicking too much.
So what I'm hearing from all three of you is a strong vote for resilience, effectively. I mean, adaptation and change, but resilience. I want to shift as we come towards the end of our conversation towards these kind of wider questions of what reading actually does for us as human beings and as a society. I mentioned John Carey in the introduction, and the way in his little book, Pure Pleasure, he makes the point about democracy, a democracy of readers being better or at least more critical than a democracy of television watchers, he puts it. It's 20 years old, the book. I mean, there seems to be some data to support that argument. The reading agency who've conducted research in this area report, for example, that adults with lower levels of literacy are more likely to believe that they have little impact on the political process and are less likely to participate in volunteer activities. There are other data which kind of support that. I'm wondering whether you are persuaded by those arguments, or whether you think that actually the danger of that is it kind of instrumentalizes reading. So reading is good, but only as far as it can improve your income potential or your understanding of civil society. Julia?
I mean, I think there's a lot of research now on the impact of reading on the individual. They've put thousands of readers into MRI scanners looking at their brain activity. And there are a variety of things that I think reading offers, whether it's fiction or non-fiction, although a lot of the research is around literary fiction. And that is that, I mean, if you're talking about democracy and, you know, the morality of encouraging reading and literacy, I think the fact that it improves your cognitive abilities, it improves your sense of empathy with others, it puts you in the shoes of other people who you may not come into contact with in your normal life. I mean, all those things that are incredibly positive. It supposedly helps with decision making, with neural networks in your brain. So, I mean, if it does all those things, then literacy and reading is something we should really promote. We should be very worried about the fact that councils have closed 180 libraries in the last 8 years. 180, that's UK alone. Mm. And that's very worrying because that's often the first access children have to books, or people on perhaps different economic scales have access to books in that way. And I think reading is, you know, obviously I'm speaking from a point of view of being in the business of books, but if reading has such a positive effect on the human brain and on society through encouraging empathy and understanding other people, then, you know, that's something that we should really care about. And whether it's, there is some research on the fact that reading a book, and like Johanna, I'm very much a page person, is better for you. But I think reading anything or listening to anything is good. Even watching films creates these imaginative connections with other people. And I think those are all very positive things.
Yeah. David, I guess he's an amen to that.
Yeah, I would. I mean, I'm interested in terms of those stats, whether literacy means, you know, actual literacy or book reading. Yeah. Pointing out the division of labour there would be interesting. I mean, I obviously books are wonderful, but they're wonderful in their own right. And I think in terms of democracy and sort of participation and all that kind of thing, I think a really important thing is what you might call information literacy, which is, and this really probably applies more to social media or news media than it does to books, but that ability to identify whether a source is authoritative or not, whether information can be relied upon, what the sort of provenance of it is.
Yeah.
But interestingly, I think an ability to discern that partly comes through reading longer form and through reading books.
Yeah.
But I definitely think there's a place for, alongside reading books as a general good, place for education specifically in information literacy. And
thank you.
Facts from fiction.
Yeah. We've got a few minutes for questions or brief comments from the audience. I believe someone will probably walk around with a microphone, I think. Yes, so if you'd like to put your hand up, we'll try and take two or three at a time. Questions or comments? We've got one over there, another one over there. So we'll take those two, one from the gentleman there, one from the gentleman there.
Yeah, it's a question about the second part of your subject, which is the future of civilization. I'd love to hear some speculation about that. And what if we are entering some kind of post-literate age?
Yep.
What does that imply?
Thank you. And thank you.
Hi, thanks. That was really interesting. I wanted to ask, my sister's 17, and when she was a kind of a child, she used to be kind of a vociferous reader of books, but I think as she's gotten older, she's really kind of gone sort of anti-book in a way. She's just completely closed off to them. She's like, no, I don't like books. I don't like reading. I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on how to sort of get her back into reading. And I don't know whether that's maybe because she wants to go into fashion, so I'm not sure whether that's, you know, she doesn't kind of see the link there, or whether it's kind of not thinking it's kind of something for her. But yeah, I just kind of want to get your thoughts on how we can kind of get her back into reading.
Thank you. My kids are 18 and 20, so I'm tempted to have a very long discussion with you after the... But we can do with that. Does anyone want to pick up the civilization point? I mean, I'm getting the strong sense from everyone of the resilience and the fact that the post-civilization language is a bit apocalyptic when it comes to books, at least. But does anyone want to respond to the gentleman's point specifically?
I mean, maybe this is just a very banal thing to say, but I think humans are essentially quite nosy, and that what the book does is it gives us access to kind of hidden information and secrets. I think, especially when you look at the novel, what the novel does is it gives us access to another human's consciousness. And yeah, that can be imitated in other forms, and a skillful filmmaker can do that. But there is nothing that quite immerses us in that way. And I think all the while we have that kind of curiosity and that desire to access another person's consciousness, then we will always want to read books. And I think that there's also something about the activity of it. What I find really fascinating and appeals to me and always has done as a reader is that combination of reading being something that is both safe and incredibly subversive. Safe because you're not falling out of a tree outside, but subversive because, you know, you're there with that book accessing information and people's ideas that feel like you're inside their brain. And there's something that inherently feels subversive. And I think as women as well, you know, there is a history there of women being discouraged from reading or being seen as frivolous or dangerous on the other end. If you're feeding them dangerous ideas or you're putting frivolous notions in their head. So I think that kind of combination of safety and subversiveness will always mean that we're quite excited by books.
Yeah, yeah. Julia, do you want to pick up the gentleman's point there about how to encourage a 17-year-old young woman to read more?
I think it speaks to what Johanna said earlier, and that people come to different things in different stages, and often you're submerged in exams at 17, and we're a very exam-oriented culture in terms of our education system right now. So I would suggest that it's something she'll probably come to in her 20s when she's got more time. But, the fact that she has a base of reading in childhood, I think, will serve her very well. It definitely helps develop your imagination and creativity. And I think the other thing that's important for reading is its impact on well-being, and especially with the epidemic of mental health crises we've had, especially with young people post-pandemic. I think anyone who knows people suffering from that should definitely encourage reading. But sounds like your sister knows exactly where she's going, and I'm sure she'll pick up books. She'll go into a bookshop and, her friend will tell her a book she's loved, or she'll watch a film and want to go back and read the book. And I have every confidence that she'll do that.
I want to close by asking a panellist one final question, which is the sign-off question for Reading Our Times, because the podcast is a podcast about books, about ideas, about us. At heart, what I'm particularly interested in is how does what we've been talking about, what does it say about us as a species, about us as a society? Janet, you've already kind of answered that in terms of our intrinsic inquisitiveness. Yeah. Anything you'd want to add?
I mean, I think I love all what Proust said about reading, which is actually sounds extremely pretentious way to frame this. But he talked about it is that you go in kind of making an encounter with the author's wisdom, and you come out learning more about your own wisdom, and that you build this intellectual sanctuary for human subjectivity. And I feel, and I think he talked about that fertile miracle of communication that takes place in the midst of solitude. And that word fertile, that's the exciting bit, I think. And that's why I think we will always come back to books. We may abandon them for a bit. We may be a bit promiscuous in our sort of reading habits or our consumption of culture. But I believe that books will always be a fertile source for us.
Nicely put. David, same question for you then. What does this say about us to your mind?
Well, I think what we've reflected on makes me think that the human appetite for sort of discovery and depth is kind of format independent, and whatever happens to the particular formats that we consume, there'll always be that appetite. Yeah. But what we do know is that books are, it's a very good format that stood the test of time, and that people haven't abandoned despite a certain amount of digital disruption. So, yeah. Books must be on something.
Nice. Julia?
Well, I think books have in many ways taken the place of oral traditions and storytelling around the fireplace or in a community or in a family. And it speaks to our desire for connectivity. And I think in today's society, where many people feel isolated and lonely, books can help fill that gap. Unless we go back to having our lovely round the fire storytelling sessions, which I would welcome. I think books have an important role to play, whatever, and in whichever way you consume them.
I think that's a suitably positive and resilient note on which to end. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. And would you please join me in thanking the panellists, Joanna, David and Juliet. Next week, we'll be coming from another festival, this time the Chalk History Festival, in which I spoke to Professor Jo Quinn about her book, How the World Made the West.
You know, I spend a lot of my time as an academic being very sceptical about the idea of certainly human nature, maybe the human condition more generally. But writing this book made me realise that actually there must be some fundamental shared assumptions that promote communication between humans.
You've been listening to Reading Our Times from the think tank Theos. It's produced by Phil Bodger. Our team includes Daniel Turner, Lizzie Harvey, and Chinny McDonald. Special thanks to Nina Humphreys, who composed our theme tune and all the music. You can subscribe to Reading Our Times on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And you can also find us on our website, theosthinktank.co.uk. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. It'll help other people find the podcast.